You're listening to Walk-Ins Welcome with me, Bridget Fettesy, on Podcast One, where everyone is welcome. This is Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you are welcome. You know the drill. Please subscribe, rate, comment, share, reach out, tell your friends, send smoke signals, whatever. We love your feedback and we want to hear from you. This week on the podcast, I am very excited to sit down with Jordan Harbinger. Jordan is a Wall Street lawyer turned podcast interviewer with an approachable style and knack for securing high profile guests. His show, The Jordan Harbinger Show, is selected as part of Apple's Best of 2018. And after listening to many of Jordan's podcasts now, I realized he's exactly the kind of person I wanted to have on this show and talk to and learn about how he got into this and how he got his start. And we just had a great conversation. I am with Jordan Harbinger, everybody. Welcome to Walk-Ins Welcome.
Is this the part where I say thanks for having me on?
Sure.
Okay, great. Say, yeah, thanks for having me on.
You could also just be like, F you, Bridget.
I just wasn't sure if you were talking to me, but I guess you were.
Yeah. I have to say, you are an example of advertising working on me.
Good.
Me being that we were advertising on our show for your podcast, and then I started listening to your podcast because of those advertisements. So it's either a genius marketing ploy or you just found somebody who really appreciates the work you're doing. And it's funny, too, because we're in such a similar space and interviewing a lot of the same people. Actually, mm-hmm. We've had a lot of similar guests and your podcast is massive. Actually, I heard what you recently talking to John Acuff. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Am I picturing it?
So John Acuff. Yeah. About overthinking things, which sounds like it might be right up your alley. Not saying that.
No,
I
listened to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And he was great. But I loved the part where you guys were talking about not letting anything land and how you were saying, you know, you'll get written up in the New York Times and be like, what's next? And he
right.
was like, you know, it's just another day, babe. It's another day that I have to go to work, when his book came out.
Yeah.
And I really identify with that. And yeah, you guys, your podcast has such a wide variety of people. So can you just let us know how you started it for people who don't know who you are and how you ended up here?
First of all, so thanks for the kind words. Yeah, I do like work really hard on the show. It's the only thing I really have to work on these days. I have kids. So like you're just watching them grow up and you're working with them. But I'm the kind of guy that if I didn't have the business to work on, I would just alienate my kids by being super annoying their entire life until they were like, we don't want to talk to you ever again. Cause you made us like run races and swim and like do violin. And like, we were your project. I don't know how we got off on my bad parenting skills, but I started the show kind of by accident. You know, I was teaching this networking course at Michigan Law, where I went to law school like 17 years ago now. And it was a course no one cared about. I'm not a professor. I never was. It was like, I went to career services because I had done this internship at a law firm and I was like, I'm going to get fired because these people are all smarter than me. And like, they're all really hardworking. And I basically had imposter syndrome, although some of it was well-founded. and one of the partners was like, don't worry about it. You'll catch up. But also the real trick is to be able to bring in business for the firm. And you do that by networking. And I was like, oh, cool. How do I network? Because I just thought like, you work really hard and you get to the top and then like you join a country club and like .. networking. And he's like, right. No, it's kind of the other way around. You make your connections on the way up. And then when you're all at the top, you all know, you've known each other for 10 years. And that's the real trick. And I was like, oh, okay. So where do I start? And I remember it like it was yesterday. Cause he goes, just be cool, man. And I was like, dude, I am a nerdy ass law student who like the last thing, people you can just say be cool, they win awards for just being cool all the time in movies. Like, I can't just be cool. I'm a first-year associate in a financial law firm. None of us really are able to do that. And he's like, oh, just, like, keep in touch with all your classmates. And I was like, oh, I wish I'd thought of that before I was, like, the class asshole at Michigan Law. You know, like, that would have helped. And I just thought, like, okay, I've got to re-engineer this whole thing. I've got to be a much more giving person. I've got to like figure this whole thing out. So I started researching networking and I started taking networking courses, and they were kind of lame. It was like,
yeah,
look him in the eye and have a firm handshake. And I'm like, cool, Dale Carnegie course guy who's teaching at the Learning Annex on Tuesdays and like can't pay rent. You know, like, do I want to take advice from you? I don't mean to be a dick, but like, true story, these are like sweater vest wearing dudes who are like doing self-published self-help books, and they're like not, they have no experience in highfalutin corporate like bullshit world that I was in. I was like, this is just theoretical for you. I can't trust you. So I started to learn like body language, nonverbal communication, vocal tonality, persuasion, influence, you know, everything like that I thought I needed to know. And then I started getting in with well-networked people that were saying things that were totally different and unique that I'd never heard. And we can talk about some of that in a bit, but like I started teaching that to law students that cared, which was like two. And then it started, the course, the sort of elective course started to get popular with women at law school. Cause guys are like, I got this, bro. I'm getting a great job. And women were like, yeah, this is a boys club. So we all need to stick together. And if this guy's going to teach networking, like we're in. So I started to teach women networking, and it was a million degrees at the law school. Cause it was like July in the summer. And so we started holding classes at a bar. And the bar was full of people on dates, and I'd be reading their body language. So the networking class turned into like Jordan reads people's date body language, and like girls and I talk about it. And it got wildly popular. And I started recording the classes because people would pop in and out and ask me something that I got asked the previous day.
Right.
So I started recording it. And then I was like, man, giving away these CDs is like, I'm burning them. People aren't giving them back. I'm charging deposits. People are keeping them even though I'm charging for them. I'm not going to get rich selling CDs for freaking $20, like one at a time every day. So my friend goes, podcasting, it's new. This is 2006. He goes, it's this brand new thing. You know, check it out. You can upload, because I said I need to be able to upload MP3 files to the internet. Like, that's how long ago this was. And it was like, there's no easy way to do this. No YouTube, no SoundCloud, nothing.
Right.
So he's like, podcasting. So I started this little podcast that was about like networking, and I thought, good, now I don't have to pass CDs around anymore at school. And then I started getting downloads from like Germany and South Africa. And I'm like, wait, how are these people finding, like, this is, it's funny because this dates me, right? Like if you put an Instagram post up and someone commented on it from the UK, you're not like, what, how did they find me? Right. You know, like, but, yeah. But back then I was like, wait, I'm putting this online. How are you finding it in South Africa? And he's like, bro, I downloaded iTunes. I looked in the podcast directory. There's like 150 of these things or 800, you know, now there's like 2 million,
right?
Literally. But he's like, there's like 800 and there's like five in the human behavior category and you're one of them. So I downloaded all of them and yours is the one that like is recorded on a quality microphone. I'm like, that's the bar. So that's how the show started. Cause I was like, this is fun. Yeah. I'm talking about things that I want. I mean, you, every podcaster, yourself included, has experienced this, right? Like you're like, wait, so I record a fun conversation with somebody that I'm interested in and I put it up there and then other people who want to hear it go find it. And it was like, that was new and novel and nobody was doing it.
Right.
And now I just defined podcasting, you know, as literally anyone can do.
Yeah, it's such a wild space, and I often think about this all the time, and I'm so grateful. I was listening to your conversation with John and just thinking, I felt like I was just sitting with you, and this is this aspect of podcasting that I love, that you have this feeling about being at a bar with somebody. It's almost like you're just sitting with your friends and listening to them have a conversation. There's such a fly on the wall, and I remember, actually, it was Glenn Beck who gave me great advice about this. He said, never forget that you're literally in their head, you know, that with radio and podcasting and podcasting in particular, because people just have you on in the background, just that you're with them in their head all while they go about their day. And he also said, you know, always respect everybody's time and attention.
Yes, I love that. That's so true.
Yeah.
I've mentioned that before, but this reminds me of that meme. Have you seen this meme where there's like three girls eating ramen and there's a person, it's like a billboard in a subway station, and then there's a person eating ramen in the subway station smiling. And it's like, this is what podcast listening is like. Cause it's like, you're totally not in the conversation, but you feel like you are.
It's so engaging though too. And I actually joke all the time that I think podcasting is saving the world right now, because it is this medium where people are having conversations and they're not totally flattened by, you know, 280 character limits, and you're not being misinterpreted and there's still tone. So I think that podcasts give me hope. They make me feel optimistic. I'll go on Twitter and be like, we're done.
Well, yeah, because Twitter, it's anonymous and you have no rapport. Like right now, if I said something like, jump off a bridge, you terrible, like I don't even want to say it because we're in a conversation. Yeah. I can't even like be as mean as people are on Twitter casually because I've already talked to you for a few minutes. I'm looking at you. Like on Twitter, right. You're just like, die in a horrible fire and I hope your dog goes with you. And you're like, dang, yeah. Bro, like you'd never do that to anybody you were talking to. You're right. There's podcasting is like this. It's this niche where we are all able to converse kind of as friends and we can develop friendships with, or I get what is it's parasocial, I think is the word I'm looking for, a parasocial relationship. And I'm sure you get this too, but people write in and they go, I know it's weird, but I feel like I know you. And I'm like, it's not weird. It's magical. Yeah. Like it's cool as hell that, you know, if somebody says, oh, hey, you look familiar. I'm like, oh, they probably saw me on Instagram or some, or like someone's YouTube. Right. And if someone says like, oh, hey, this idea you had, blah, 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 was really good. I'm like, oh, they probably heard me on someone else's show. But if somebody comes up to me and they act like they've known me for 10 years and they're asking me about my vacation to Poland.
Yeah.
I know they listen to the podcast because there's a level of disclosure and familiarity that my mom uses, that my like closest friends use with me. And it's not weird. It's so cool that you can scale that for the first time in human history.
It is really cool. It's such a good point. And I was talking about this with my cousin who produces this. We always joke that our family has no idea what we're doing.
Right.
And my podcast listeners and the people in my subscriber community, and now we work out every day at noon. Yeah. And they know me better than my own family members. You know, in many ways, they know what's going on in my life more up to speed. I'm pretty sure a lot of my family members don't even know I have a podcast.
Yeah, that's for sure true. My mom listens to my show, so she's always like, I heard that this and this and this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. I mentioned that in like my ad spot in the Daniel Pink episode of the show. Like my mom will call and say that. And I just think that that's really, it's great because you're right. A lot of people do need it, especially right now during the pandemic. You've got people who feel more isolated than ever. And the last thing we need to do is be like, buy access to my inner circle on this thing, or you can't find out what I'm doing, or like, you know, buy this mouthwash that I'm posing for in a photo. Look how great my life is. Whereas like, it's the opposite of Instagram in many ways. Whereas Instagram, it's like, oh, I'm on a beach. I'm just eating a perfect bowl of strawberry covered cereal and I'm wearing matching pajamas that match my room decor. And podcasting is like, I'm pretty sure that I'm still hungover from Monday. It's now Friday afternoon and I feel like my life is going backwards. And I don't know why I'm telling all of you this, but that's the way it is. And like, I'm pretty sure that I'm getting dumped on the weekend and FML. And everyone's like, I relate. You know,
yeah.
It's great. It's great and necessary.
There's something so able to connect to people on that. And you're right. It is so necessary right now because I do think, what is that whole study that they do that people don't even have like five people who are close to them anymore?
That's fucking depressing, right? That like, and I saw that stat and I go, this can't be true. Cause I don't know about you. You seem like an extroverted, fun person. I was not growing up. Like I was quiet and shy, especially during college. And I thought, wait a minute. How can me, a guy who studied, was like a nerd by all accounts in college, who had, I had plenty of friends. I probably had like five good friends and like 20 less good friends that I still hung out with. Now the study, let's find this. It's like the average person has like one or zero close friends. And it's
like
how?
I don't know. There's that book. It was called Bowling Alone or something like that. It is tragic if this is true. I don't actually know how it's possible, but
there's a lot of I'm looking now and there's like a million different news answers in the news for this. One's like, oh, has 19. I'm like, that sounds right, but I know the one you're talking about, which is, it seems more legit. And it was literally like one third of the people responded or something. Some huge number was like, I have no friends, zero.
Yeah.
What?
Or somebody that they could call on in like a real, an emergency.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that as things get more fragmented, I'm really glad that there's this ability to connect online. And during the pandemic in particular, I really saw this. It became our community around Walk-Ins Welcome particularly became, and you probably saw this too, it became like a self, you know, like a support group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They just kind of spontaneously started helping each other. And that was really amazing to see people in the community that you kind of create space for. It's weird when you create these spaces and then the space carries you.
Yes, takes on a life of its own. I fully agree. Like, I didn't start a business podcast. I was an attorney, right?
Yeah.
Or a podcast as a business, I should say. I was an attorney. And then eventually my network thing turned into like a dating and advice show. And I ended up on Sirius XM satellite radio. But I kept doing the podcast because I was like, there's just more magic here than like prank calls on to me or like dating advice. Like, it's just
right
and the format's open, you know, I can interview someone for an hour. And I remember trying that on Sirius and they were like, yo, max 10 minutes with a guest, max. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Like, these that's are like interesting the
old,
people.
Yeah, that's that old school media hit
yeah.
mentality.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that drove me crazy. So I kept the podcast going. And then eventually people were like, I want to hire you for consulting or this and that. And then when the economy tanked, I was in real estate finance. So like subprime mortgage backed securities, you know, like the problem that crashed everything in 2008. I was doing that. I was like 27. So they basically said, hey, all of you who are have been here for like a year or two, you're totally useless outside of this narrow niche that doesn't exist anymore. Go find another job. And I was like, I like what I'm doing now. So I started doing this, and then now there's like podcast ads. There weren't even ads before, so I can basically right. be like, hey, buy a mattress, and if not, here's my guest again, and like go on with my life. You know, I don't have to become a life coach or anything, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I can just like do this creative thing and make money doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So what were some of the things you mentioned that you were learning when you were doing that early version of your podcast when you were selling mixtapes?
Yeah, selling mixtapes, exactly, out of the trunk.
Your dating advice mixtapes.
Yeah, the first thing was there was no blueprint for this, and I know that sounds maybe a little cliche, but it's so true. Like, there was nobody was like, here's how you build a business online, because the
right.
only people that were doing anything online were like really shady email marketers, which is kind of like, they're still around, but it's not the same people. It's people who are like, let me tell you how to turn $100 into $1,000. And it's like pyramid schemes or people selling ebooks. And I was like, I'm just not into this because it's all high pressure sales tactics on these weird sales pages. And I knew people at Google who were like, yeah, we're trying to destroy that business model. And I'm like, do I want to bet against Google being able to do that? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And it, like I said before, it was kind of an accidental business, right? So I would do my show, I guess. At that point, I acknowledged that it was like a show. I'd talk about like dating and relationships and networking. And then some people would go, can you just teach this to me on the phone? I'll give you $100 an hour. And I was like, what? Because that was, when you're a student, that's insane money. Like
yeah.
bonkers.
Not so even was, just a student.
No, that's, but like, especially when you're a student and you're,
yeah.
the job you had before was $7.25 an hour. No, $5.25 an hour back then at a movie theater, or $5.75, yeah. whatever it was. Like, that was, there was no way that I was going to turn that down. So I did that. And then I remember talking about that on the show and people were like, oh, we can pay you for coaching. Okay. So I had all these coaching clients, and I just remember one of my friends, I was working at his house. And he's like, I got to go take care of some errands or something. Like, he worked at a lab. And I sat out on the hammock and I was doing my Skype calls. And then he came back in like 4 hours and I was still on the hammock. And he's like, oh, what'd you do all day? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I made like $600. And he's like, what? Because that's insane. I'm like, yeah, we're onto something here, man. Like, this is a real thing.
Yeah.
So another guy said, this is how my business evolved. Another guy said, hey, I don't really understand. I mean, I understand conceptually all these things that you're saying, but I really want to come see them in person. And I was like, well, I'm not going to have a stranger over to my house. Like, forget it. And he's like, I'll give you $10,000 if I can stay with you for 2 weeks. And I was like, here's my address. Right. So that was this guy who's like a street magician who was doing really well. Came to my house in New York where I was working on Wall Street and was like, I just want to kind of follow you around in the evening. During the day, I realize you're at work. I'm just going to explore New York. But in the evening, like, I want to go out. And I was like, all right. So I went out and he was like, this is great. I'm learning so much. So on the next episode of the podcast, I was like, yeah, we had Frank come in and, you know, he's staying with me and he's like shadowing me. And people were like, wait, I can shadow you for a week for $5,000? And I was like, Yeah, you can. So I had so many guys that wanted to do this that I started to hire other people that were like really good at meeting people and like going out and being social and charismatic and teaching the stuff. So I sort of accidentally started a company, but based on demand, not based on like, I saw this TV show where these guys pick up girls and I can totally do that. It was like, give advice, people want more. Train someone in person, people want more. And I was like, wow, okay, we're onto something. I don't know shit about business at all, but like, this is a good business, because most people come up with an idea and then try and like cram it down the throat of the market. And we didn't even have the idea. And the market came to us and was like, you should do this. And here's money. Take it right now.
Right.
So that was really cool. And that's sort of the beginning. That was like the first 10 years I did a podcast and I sold training.
Wow. And then what happened to that podcast?
It's still going. I actually ended up with a disagreement between my business partners where they were like, we want you to keep doing dating shows. Because I had started interviewing like Jonathan Haidt, who you've had on the show recently, and like Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I had, you know, all these like really cool scientists and authors and Mark Cuban. Mike Shermer, like guys like that. And Ray Dalio, and like just really, really fascinating people. And they were like, yeah, you're getting, I'm like, our audience is growing. The people are smarter. They're like, what if you focus on dating? Because we sell dating training. And I'm like, look, guys, I'm 35, like I'm 41 now, but back then it's like, I'm 35 years old. I'm getting married. I'm going to have kids. There's a point at which not only is it disingenuous of me talking about dating, which I'm not doing anymore, but it's just pure cringe at this point. Cause I'm not doing it. I don't know like how to use Tinder. So what am I going to, I'm just going to like fake my way through that. It's a totally different game. Why don't you guys do it? And they were like, no, we don't want to do it. You should do it. So they were like, my business partners wanted to make me do this really cringe, inauthentic thing, but they didn't want to put any skin in the game, but it's my face on the whole thing. So I'm like, great. Right. So I get to look like a total turd, like weirdo online, like pickup artist wannabe type guy. And you guys get to cash the checks and like deliver
the product. In the Me Too era.
Yeah, in the Me Too era. This is luckily before the Me Too era. So when I left, Me Too then kicked off like the year after that. And I remember thinking, wow, y'all are teaching dating stuff online publicly in the Me Too era. And I just hard pivoted. Like now I only have, you know, the Ray Dalio, Jonathan Haidt, Chelsea Handler, or like whoever, whatever personality that I have on the show, like pickpockets and cyber criminals and just really fascinating people, like people infiltrate North Korea. So I don't want to talk dating, and it's great. So yeah, I sort of left them in the dust, and a lot of people were like, oh my God, how are you going to rebuild this giant podcast that you were on? And I didn't need to, because when I started this iteration of the show, which is the Jordan Harbinger show, basically like 60% of the audience converted in the first 30 days. And even now, 3.5 years later, people are like, yeah, you were on that other show that I loved, and then I like you weren't, so I sort of unsubscribed, and then I just forgot about you, and then I heard an ad, and now I'm like back in the fold, right? So it's really interesting how the podcast audience sort of picks up like an old friend. Like, yeah. I remember you from here. So I'm glad that I pivoted, and I'm really lucky, because my disagreement with my business partners was nasty. Like, we had agreed on an amicable split, and then they were like, oh, wait. If we just say fuck you and not give you anything, you're screwed and we can keep all of the money in the business. So I was like, ugh, what am I going to do? And then I went to our network, Podcast One, and they were like, we're going to support you. And I was like, wow, that's really nice of you. So I started over with basically nothing except for Podcast One's sort of like pat on the backside, which turned out to be really important. And then my old company sued me for competing with them, but obviously they lost, because you can't screw someone over and not pay them any shares of stock that they own in the company and then be like, and you can't work in California. Yeah. Like, it doesn't work. So they ended up spending like hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal fees only to eventually settle for giving me everything that I created over the past 11 years. Wow. So it was kind of funny, but it's an interesting sort of life lesson in there too, because by the time that lawsuit was over, in which I came out on top, I didn't care anymore.
Right.
And that's how it is a lot with life, right? Like, you're like, I'm going to screw you over since you tried to screw me. And then like, you just do really well. And you're like, eh, all right, thanks for the check, whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting how that works. So what that taught me was like, always try and move forward and keep momentum. Even if somebody's trying to like screw you over, your ex, whatever it is, just keep that forward momentum. And like, the more you get bogged down in other people's like dramatic bullshit, you're kind of letting them win, as cliche as it sounds, right?
Well, what's that old cliche, you know,
the best revenge is to live well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's so true. And I thought it was bullshit that like nice people said, and I'm like, I'm not that good of a person, right? But it's true. It's like it really is. The best thing you can do is move on. And it's not even just the revenge part. It's this is what works better.
Right.
Because like people who are concerned with fucking you over, they're not building their business. They're just working on fucking you over. So at the end of the lawsuit, even though they lost, but even if they had won, they would have done nothing in the business in the meantime. So I focused on just building. And by the time I won, I was like, oh, there's like nothing here that I really want. I'll take all my intellectual property, but I'm already five times larger than y'all. So like, whatever. Yeah.
We have a lot of similarities in the, it's funny you mentioned, you said something, I almost started crying because I started my website Fetacy in 2006. And it's a word I made up to mean when reality becomes parody, which in 2005, 2006 made no sense at all when I started my first website. And when you said, you know, no one really knew how to make money or yet on doing things like what we're doing. I went bankrupt and I was trying to like cram an idea down the market, but I also had no help and I was just a 26-year-old idiot had an idea and put my money into it and then went bankrupt. And I never really gave up on the dream. The original dream was greeting cards and then it kind of expanded into, it's a long story. So then I had a podcast bench. I worked at Playboy. I don't know if you know anything about my trajectory, but I was at Playboy in like 2015 and I was doing a podcast benched and it was giving dating advice with my friend. We were both divorced in our late 30s and kind of like benched, but we were still dating and I was writing a column for Playboy. Then I started doing the Playboy Advisor and then I got, you know, sober and life started changing and I stumbled into this space and started talking to a lot of the people that you mentioned as well. And I just decided to kind of pivot. It was a weird time to be a Playboy and be talking about sex and relationships and that like Me Too era. And it was really amazing to be writing for men because I don't know that anybody was really talking to them. And I think this is also the phenomenon of like Jordan Peterson in many respects.
Yeah, that's true.
Then I started Walk-Ins Welcome, which is now just like you, conversations with anyone. I've talked to porn stars and I just like having conversations with anyone. And I think the story is that anyone have about how they overcame grit and resilience, like what you were talking about. This is so important and why I was joking with my little workout crew right before I logged on. I'm like, I'm going to talk to Jordan about my existential crisis. He seems like a good person to have this conversation.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
The reason I was saying you're a good person to talk to is it seems like the thing I love about your podcast is that there are those little nuggets from every single episode. There is some takeaway that I can take like, oh, that stuck out to me. What for you have you learned the most about talking to all of these people who are just kind of, you know, these giants in their industries?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do get that a lot of it. I think I have to separate it into different buckets, right? Because people go like, what's the number one takeaway that you've got? And it is true. There's a lot of really, really smart, amazing, talented folks on any given podcast, right? But I will say some of the stuff that sticks out isn't always like, oh, everyone's just really determined or whatever, like, you know, kind of cliche thing. One thing I noticed that I think is telling and sort of indicative of maybe a mindset that a lot of these folks have is, let's say that you try and email Dennis. Well, he's a bad example. I was going to say Dennis Rodman, but let's pick somebody who's like more normal than that. Because if I pick him, people are like, well, of course you couldn't get an answer from him. Let's say I try and email an economist or something like that, or like Neil deGrasse Tyson. Even he's a bad example. Let me find somebody in my list here before I just talk out of my backside. Let's say you email somebody who's a popular author, okay?
Right.
But they're not super famous. You may never hear back. And there's a reason for that. You know, they get a lot of email, or like you're emailing some influencer, they get tons of DMs, it doesn't work. I've noticed though, when I email Ray Dalio or like Mark Cuban, I'll get an answer in a couple of days or at the most. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I can email a billionaire and get a response from their phone. But when I try and email like an Instagrammer, I can't get a reply to save my life, even after like sending a properly formatted pitch, CCing everybody who's in their team that works on these things. And what I realized was that yes, these people are more organized. Yes, they're a little bit more go-getters. Yes, they've got their information and communication locked down a little bit better. But it's also about the people that surround them on their team. You know, like, I know that sometimes Mark Cuban, or most of the time Mark Cuban is replying to the emails himself. Right. Ray Dalio, probably not as much. But these Instagram folks, they'll have like 17 assistants, but they're all like 18-year-olds that are just sort of leeches that think like if they hang around long enough, they'll be in collab videos and build their own channel, whatever it is. Whereas people who are really good at what they do, they surround themselves with all-star teams. And they also surround themselves with people on their team that complement their weaknesses, which might sound really obvious, but as yet I've found the majority of people who are running businesses, like, they can't do this well. They will... Right. Like, Danny Trejo will be like, okay, I know I don't know how to use technical things because I'm Danny Trejo and I, like, was in prison and doing drugs and now I'm an actor. I'm not good at Zoom. So he's got people for that, and those people are courteous and responsive and they show up on time, whereas you'd find another creator who hires other creators that don't complement their weaknesses at all but are just people that, like, agree with them or like their work, and the whole business is a fucking train wreck.
Right.
And,
right.
And you see how they limit their upside by not being able to figure out where their weak points are and then make up for them. And it's kind of like with my wife, for example, she's like super organized. Everything's got systems. She's always on top of it. She never loses her temper, or, like, you know, rarely, I should say. She did this morning, but I deserved it, honestly. But, like, you know, I know that I'm more like, I don't want to do this. And she's like, nope, you're hungry and you're doing it, but you're doing it after you eat. And then I'll, like, eat and she's like, see? I'm like, yeah, this is fun. Thanks for making me do that, right? Or she's like, you're going to show up on time, da-da-da, here's what your week looks like. Like, it's a whole thing. But I found that a lot of people, they don't have that in their life. And it can really cause a lot of, like, spiraling, whether it's in your business or not, it can really screw you up. So the one thing I would say, if I had to pick one thing, it's know what your strengths are, but more importantly, know what your weaknesses are. And if you're running a business, you need to hire for those weaknesses. You know, it's 2021. You can't be like, I don't understand how to set up technology, so I'm going to ignore it. You know, like, I don't know how to do my taxes. I'm only 20, but I made $10 million last year. It'll be fine. Like, that's how you end up going to prison or having your business ruined. Or having your business ruined by something that's totally avoidable, right? Like, hire a freaking adult to, like, handle important shit. And that's part of knowing you can't do that unless you know exactly what you're good at and what you are not good at, and you're not deluding yourself. And I think a lot of us, we delude ourselves into thinking that we can handle anything, when the truth is it's okay to, like, ask for help. And there's probably a deeper metaphor in there too, right?
Yeah, I definitely am surrounded. I was looking at everybody on my team and they are so organized, and I am, like, the classic creative disorganized. I mean, my desktop is super clean right now because I took Saturday to clean it up, but usually it's like this source of shame where if someone's around, I'm hiding it. I have 17 documents open. My team is like, I don't know how you, this gives me anxiety. Yeah. You know, like, I'm definitely not a zero inbox person. My husband is. He's very organized, has systems for everything. And I think that my business partners too, they're just like, love spreadsheets and have these weird, like, nothing gets me off like a spreadsheet.
Those people are a different breed. My wife will be like, check this out. When you change a cell in this spreadsheet, it automatically knows to go in this other spreadsheet, and then it changes it to match it with this minus that other one. And I'm like, cool. And she's like, no, you don't get it. This is amazing. Be more impressed. Be more impressed than you are right now. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, Excel's like a whole thing for people. It's like a fetish.
Such thing. Yeah. My cousin Maggie, she's the same way. She's like, there's just something so satisfying about a spreadsheet that works. And I'm like, okay, I don't understand this at all.
They do these macros where it's like, no, if you hold L command caps lock FG spacebar backspace return, look what happens. And you're like, can't you just click and drag that? And they're like, no, you got to do the keystrokes.
Yeah.
You can do it faster.
It's a whole culture.
It is.
So in terms of what's your big picture vision? You know, what are you moving towards?
So this sounds corny, but I'm going to say it anyway. The idea that I can build something big that impacts a lot of people is really great and really satisfying, especially when I was a kid, I wanted to be a talk show host. When I was like eight, I wanted to be on the radio. now I'm kind of doing that, right?
Yeah.
But like in my own way, now I don't have to play top 40 music. Like I don't have to play like Bush on repeat, you know, or whatever.
You're dating yourself.
Yeah, I know. There's no getting around it. Like Stone Temple Pilots or whatever. So
we're almost the same age. I'm a year older than you.
Yeah, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that, and it's fun, and it makes the whole thing not really feel like work that much. But also, there's something really satisfying about it being my own thing. Not there's anything wrong with people working for someone else. I hate when like business owners are like, if you're working for someone else, you're building their dreams. It's like, well, no, sometimes you just want to get paid to like do your thing that you're good at and then go to Paris and like go shopping and drink coffee think about the fact that you're running a business and every second you spend drinking that coffee, looking at the Eiffel Tower is time wasted, which is what a lot of business owners are like. But
the ability to clock out.
Yeah.
That is something nice.
Business owners don't have that. Like, I will never be like, I'm not thinking about work at all. That's like, I can't even tell you. Even there are times when I'm playing with my 2-year-old son and I'm like, okay, this is okay because even though I'm not being productive, I'm playing with my 2-year-old son. And I'm like, the fact that I'm even having to rationalize this in my head is disgusting. Like, this is the meaning of life right here in your arms and like in the sandbox next to you. And you're like, well, if I work till 11, I can finish the emails that I have. And it's like, good Lord, be present.
Yeah.
So I love the idea that I can do things, I can have flexibility with my time, do things that are impactful and reclaim my time in that way. But also, it's really nice to be able to create something that helps other people. And so, yes to the impact, but also, like, you know, if you're running a radio show and people go, hey, I really like when you guys answer questions because that one time you answered a question, it really helped me. You don't go to your station manager and go, we should play less music and I should be giving more advice. They're going to be like, cool, but no, and not ever. And why are you still in my office? You know, that's not it. But if you're doing a podcast, you can go, you know, whenever I have these types of guests, I have more fun doing it and my audience is enjoying it too. So I'm just going to do more of that. And it's like, mm-hmm. you really can do whatever you want. You know, you can, mm-hmm. you work out with your community and stuff. Like mm-hmm. you can't, radio hosts can't be like, you know what? We're just going to do a workout. It's like, that's not a thing. And so you're leading a community. They're looking to you for advice. They're looking to you for help. If you ever need them, they're there for you too, which it sounds almost like it's not even true because it's so interesting. But it really helped me get through a lot of crap in my life, just having like amazing people send me nice emails and share the new work that we're doing. So there's something there that you don't get when you're like selling scented cotton balls, you know, for Bausch & Lomb or whatever. You're just never going to get that. When I was a lawyer, I got no fan mail. Go figure.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing that keeps me grounded. I don't know how much. Do you take a lot of crap? It seems like you're pretty immune to that.
No, I can see though you might take more because you have some conservative type the stuff on here that's like a little bit. I don't even know if conservative is the right word, but you have people.
I mean,
on,
I
like,
definitely have conservatives. I'm not afraid to like cross the aisle and talk to people because I think that's a really dumb thing that's hurting our culture.
Yeah.
And I stumbled into that space just opening my mouth on Twitter. So it was, I feel like I always joke like I got caught in the crossfire of the culture wars just because I came kind of out of a blackout from being drunk for 20 years, got sober, started working at Playboy, which in and of itself put me in the very online community. And then I was tweeting and saying things like, writing things like, oh, that's not what a real man does. And it was like, this is toxic masculinity. I'd never even heard any of these terms. So I was really truly like just an idiot who came out of a coma. And then Trump got elected and it was just like everything ramped up to 11. And I happened to be in comedy when comedians were getting canceled. So it was just wrong place at the right or wrong time, depending on how you look at it. And
then
I got to know a lot of these people and, you know, whether I agree with their politics or not, I think they have really interesting stories and advice. And not to bring up Glenn Beck again, say what you will about his politics, but he was the one who said, save those emails that people write to you, the nice ones, put them in a folder. And on days when you're wondering what I'm doing or is this worth it or why am I doing this or you're feeling burned out, go read those emails for energy and for, you know, that like juice to keep you, to remind you why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, we've got a company Slack channel where one of my team members just takes all of our reviews that are sensible, like not the ones where they're like, you're fat and ugly and also, you know, look like a goat. Like, we don't put those in there. But the positive ones, because before I was the only one who would ever check reviews, and I would just sort of check once a month and I'd skim them and look through. And then it was like, this is such a waste because these people like created Apple accounts and logged in and wrote this like nice thing that they knew we might see. And half the team has never seen a review. So if we dump them into a Slack channel, people can, like, our transcriptionist can be like, man, what about, is anybody even reading these? And then it's like, here's a channel full of nice things people have said about our work that gets added to every single day. And it really is awesome because I don't have a lot of days where I'm like, what's the point? But I do have the occasional, this was late and now that's late. And then I like stub my toe getting out of bed. And then like I'm out of food. So I'm hangry. And then I found out that this person canceled on me. So now I'm fucked on that angle. And it's like, you know, maybe I need a vacation for sure. But also maybe instead of that, I can also just look at this Slack channel and realize that every time we put something out, we put a lot of care into it. Everyone who listens to the Jordan Harbinger show is like making it time for us every week to listen. And that is the highest compliment anybody can give you. You know, like it's even more than money. Although money's great too, because it keeps the lights on. It's really great to see someone go, I never miss an episode. And I'm like, wow, you spend more time with us than you spend with your best friend every single week.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah. That's something that I never take for granted. I just am so grateful for, and that's why I am so appreciative. Even when people don't have money, to me, time is the most valuable thing. It's just the only resource we have that we can't get more of. And it's so precious. So I'm always it is very humbling when I really sit and think about it, that people will listen and engage. And it's such a, I'm very grateful. My days where I'm like, what's it all for, are generally more when I'm taking like a whirl, you know, I'm still writing opinion pieces, and I'm not a victim. I'm putting myself in the line of fire in many respects, but sometimes I guess I haven't reached the like monetary threshold where it outweighs the like, what am I doing this for?
Yeah. I hear
being
that.
Being abused for accolades.
Right. Like
like being a waitress.
Yes, exactly. I saw the Cosby piece. I have it bookmarked. I haven't read it yet, but I can only imagine, you know, what it shows in the comment section of wherever that has been posted on your, even on your own social. And you're just like, yeah, look, until you get to I assume this is an assumption. I would imagine the only people who see crazy, angry letters that personally attack them and just smile to themselves, they're so big that they're laughing on their yacht or their jet or something. And they're like, whatever, dude, you know, scoreboard. but everyone else, like every other journalist who writes an opinion piece and gets like a death threat, is like, why did I do that again?
Journalists in particular. Yeah. It's already such a thankless job.
Yeah.
And like, then you're making, like, screw you.
You're like in Manhattan making $47,000 a year trying to figure out how you're going to pay your dry cleaning bill. And someone's like, I hope you die. I'm going to find you. I know where you work. And you're like, oh my gosh, what?
The true genius is Dana Loesch. She like monetizes her hate mail. She's pretty famous. She was like with the NRA and she was in a big CNN debate and everybody hates her.
Yeah.
And she takes her hate mail, her like hate, and she gets it sponsored, and it's a sponsored segment that she makes money on. I was
that
like,
that is pretty good. Oh, is this the one from NRA TV?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I recognize her. Yep. I recognize her. That's actually not a bad idea to sort of. Yeah.
I mean, you seem like it would be more on brand to do the positive, you know, feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd have a lot more material. My negative emails are stupid, though. They're not even good. Like, I would imagine if you're Dana Loesch, you have some well thought out kind of horrifying emails.
Yeah.
My negative stuff is usually like, you're a simpleton who doesn't even understand. And I'm like, understand what? There's no context here. You just sent in like a random tweet or a random email. Like, I'd have to engage you in conversation to figure out what you're even talking about. My nice emails are like three paragraphs of like how this has changed their life and allowed them to like spend more time with their family. So yeah, I could do that, but I haven't, because it seems pretty self-serving to be like, here's some, thanks for everyone, here's some nice stuff somebody said about me this week, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
That would be amazing, though. Yeah. So almost perfect.
It's a bit much.
What? Yeah, it's a little over the top. The hate mail you can get away with.
Yeah.
What is the thing that you've learned the most about from interviewing people?
About interviewing,
the actual
you mean?
Skill, yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say that. So a lot of times in the beginning, when people are trying to like teach interviewing, they're like, make sure you know what you're going to ask, make sure you're prepared, obviously. But then people write down all these questions that they want, and I still do this. But the problem is, once you write the questions, you have to be able to get rid of the questions ride with the conversation. So like newbie interviewers, they tend to do this wrong. You know, they'll go, so, Bridget, how did you get your start? And then they're just like looking at their notes while you talk. And then you're like, and then, you know, you're ending up your comment. And then you're like, and that's the time that I decided that never again. And I was going to embark on this fantastic journey. And then instead of following that with like something about your journey, they're like, what's your favorite book about business? And you're like, oh, I get it. You're just asking these questions. Like, you're not listening to me at all. Listening is key, but not just listening to what they have to say. You have to constantly have the material alive in your head. Like if you read a science book, and I'm talking with like Danny Kahneman or I'm talking with Malcolm Gladwell or something, I have to have the material alive in my head is kind of like where it is. Like I have to understand it enough, not just sort of be vaguely familiar with it. Understand it enough to where I can say, okay, you just said this one thing, but like in the end of your book, you said this other thing. Isn't that the opposite of what you're saying now? And right. What you find is not only does your audience appreciate that, not only does it make for a great interview, but there's something that clicks in the mind of the interviewee when you do this, where they go, oh, okay, this person is not only paying attention, they not only consumed my work, but they're thinking about it in a way that maybe even I haven't thought about it. And if I have thought about it, I obviously didn't do a good enough job explaining it because he has this question that I thought was answered in the book. So that's when they go, huh, okay, that's a really good question. Let me think about this. And then they give you a real answer that hasn't appeared anywhere else that nobody else has ever asked them.
Yeah.
And it's great for the audience because maybe they've heard Mark Cuban 48 times already, but they've never heard Mark Cuban get stumped on something and then come back with a real well-thought-out answer. They've heard, like, media bites. They've never heard Malcolm Gladwell have to, like, rethink an answer that he wrote about in a book and then go, maybe I should check on that and get back to you. Like, that never happens.
Right.
So being able to do that on the fly is a skill. It takes a lot of work, but it mostly just takes a lot of prep. And there's really no substitute for that. You know, people will try and prep for an interview by Googling your Wikipedia, reading through that, or reading the bio on your about page. And you can tell when it's that kind of interview because they go, Jordan Harbinger has received his master's in economics from the University of Michigan. And they're just reading it. And you're like, it's going to be that kind of interview where you just know that stuff. I like to over prepare and then like throw stuff away. But when I had Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs on the show,
I love him. I want to talk to him.
He's great.
Yeah.
I literally found a story from his college roommate's kid that his college roommate told us about, like, well, oh yeah, Mike, one time he did this funny thing. So I brought it up before the show and Mike Rowe was like, oh, and like you could tell, he went from like, all right, I'll just do this media thing. Like he wasn't upset. He was just like, it's another media thing. He went from that to, oh, so how do you know my college roommate's kid? Like that's got to be an interesting story. And then the whole show is just us having a really chill conversation. So the more sort of rapport you can get with the guest prior to the show, the better. And it's not just, you can't just like laugh at one of their jokes and then you're off to the races. You really do have to show that you've put in enough work.
I'm the same way where I have to read the book and I want to do all that. I have a whole list of questions that I have to be willing to throw out because sometimes you'll just get, and it's the same. It's definitely a skill. And I listen to even my old interviews when I first started. And
so cringe, right?
Just, yeah, it's like listening to old stand up. It's just the same. It's even getting interviewed is a muscle, you know, it's
true.
A completely different muscle than interviewing somebody. And I can see even just in some of the appearances I've done, multiple appearances in places, and then seeing the first versus the third or something. And it just clearly you get better at speaking more articulately when you're just speaking constantly.
Yeah,
hopefully.
You get your your bites down or whatever,
and
your reps in. Yeah. And it's good to be interviewed in long form, right? Because if you do a bunch of, let's say like you do a bunch of morning radio to like talk about your comedy tour, it's always like, so what is your focus on this set? And then it's like, thanks for coming in. Bye. You know, like it's just that. But when you do long form, you can't hide behind your like, oh, thanks for asking, Tom. You know, like your sound bites, you run out of that shit
talking
15
points.
Minutes in. Yeah, talking points. You run out of that shit 15, 20 minutes in. And then the rest of the hour or whatever you're doing on your podcast is like, guess I'll just answer this question honestly because I'm out of runway on the crap I prepped with my publicist last month. And that's the real shit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you can't hide for maybe an hour. You can hide behind your talking points, but by hour two or three, if you're just a talking points person and you haven't actually put any thought into your thoughts, that will be revealed. It will be eventually revealed.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is like the master of give someone enough rope and let them hang themselves with it.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. It's like you can go in thinking aliens built the pyramids along with the guests, but after they start, the nonsense can only last so long. And then you're like, this person really hasn't thought about that this much, have they?
Yeah, that's really fun. I think a lot of the people who listen to this would particularly be interested in, you know, you seem very positive, upbeat, like always moving forward. What was your dark night of the soul? Have you had those moments?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I had to restart the Jordan Harbinger show from my previous podcast, I was like, is this possible? I've done the other show for 11 years.
Wow.
Also, I started it in 2006. So you start to think, okay, did I just get lucky with first to market back then? Also, if I wasn't just lucky, what if it takes me like 15 years to rebuild this thing because it takes longer now? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that was even more kind of hard on me was you do something for so long, you're Jordan Harbinger of XYZ. You've got an identity wrapped into your occupation. So when that occupation is not yours anymore, are you still the same person? And it's really cliche for or easy for like a life coachy type Instagrammer would be like, of course, you're always who you are. But it's like, wait. If you are a lawyer that has your own firm and then you get sued into oblivion and you have to close it down, are you still that guy or are you now just formerly that person? And like, what are you, where's your value come in? Like, what if, and I think a lot of Hollywood people deal with this too, where they're like, let's say you were super famous for being on like Miami Vice. You can't go around in 2021 being like, yeah, I'm on this show called Miami Vice. You might see it in reruns in Kazakhstan. You know, like you can't lean on that anymore because it's weird. But like, who are you outside of that show? Are you just the guy who was in Miami Vice? Like, is that sad now? What is your thing? So that's why, and you see this a lot with like people who've done something that was super popular in like 2000 or 1999, and they're doing something else now. And you're like, I think I can give this in as an example because it doesn't make her look bad. So I was going to interview Justine Bateman. It hasn't happened yet. She's really an interesting character, and she talks a lot about like fame and addiction and stuff like that in various books. Well, when I was booking or starting to do the booking process, her publicist was like, she doesn't want to talk about family ties that much. And I was like, no problem. Do people still do that? And they're like, yes, all the time. And I'm thinking, wow, imagine being on a show from 1984 to 1989. And like, people are like, so Mallory, what do you think about Michael J. Fox, Alex P. Keaton for president? Right. And she's like, for God's sake, I've got two books and like 14 TV series since then. So that's kind of that same feeling, except for, without even the upside of trying to do something else, when you have the rug ripped out from under you and it's unexpected, you just don't know who you are anymore. And I know that might sound like, it might sound like cry me a river. You lost one business and you built another one. But I think when it's your business and you don't know if your new one is going to succeed, it's like the worst feeling ever because you didn't plan it. It seems unfair. And not only it's not like your restaurant went under and you have three more. Let's like, you don't know what you're going to do the next day. And that feeling sucks. It's so
horrible.
I think
a lot of people are going through this right now. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people have lost their small businesses. And yeah, it's easy with hindsight to say that to you. But in that moment, you didn't know what would happen moving forward. And what you're describing in terms of that feeling of who are you isn't just an Instagram influencer or all of us are brands. I'm watching a lot of my aunts and uncles who are approaching retirement going through this because they're so identified with their job and that's they've been doing it for 30, 40 years. So this is something that everybody goes through at a certain point in their life. Many people go through. You see it with parents when their kids leave the house. You know, who am I as a mother now that I don't have kids at home? And so I think that identity crisis is something that resonates with everyone, I would expect. Are you spiritual?
Not that much.
It didn't strike from what I've heard. I didn't want to assume anything, but it doesn't.
Yeah, I'm more of like a sciencey guy. Not that you can't be both, but I definitely lean towards not so much of that. But it's not because I think it's dumb or anything. I just haven't really gotten into anything specific over the course of my life, I would say, yet, you know.
So in those moments when you're feeling lost, I guess, or you're having that identity crisis, what do you lean into?
My relationships with people that I know and love. Like, I really am sort of... It's not just like, call a friend and feel better. It's like, okay, this is when you go, hey, person I've known for like 5 years, I need to have a real heart-to-heart where like you're not taking your kids to school during the time, like you're outside walking and I'm outside walking, that kind of thing. Or like, you know, and you need to like, I need to like talk with them and go, am I a failure right now? Like, what do you think? And then they'll go, no, no, man, you're totally good. What are you talking about? And you're like, no, but really. You know, and then they'll go, okay, like you have to get past their sort of like facade of like, I'm just going to make you feel better. But you almost have to give people warning. Like, it's going to be one of those conversations where I'm like, don't just tell me what I want to hear, but also don't be too hard on me because I'm fucking fragile right now.
Right.
You know, and like only your close friends can do that. Your parents maybe, or they might be the worst people to call in those moments, depending on who your parents are. But my parents are good-ish with that. Like, what's that?
I said that would be me.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks like that. But like close friends, certain family members, you can be like, you know, am I this person? Am I really this person that I thought I was? Am I not this person that I thought I was? And like, that's how my community helped me too, because I was pretty transparent about all of that in the beginning of the Jordan Harbinger show. There's like, I talk about like the uncertainty and like where I'm feeling. And a lot of people really resonated with that. It was funny because I got one review that was like, just move on. And it was so callous that I had to laugh because I was like, damn. But a lot of the community was like, no, you've helped with this and this. And I've never told you because you're just an anonymous guy on the internet. But like, no, this is so important. Keep going. And you realize how important these relationships really are. Not just the ones you have with your show fans, but like your close friends, your loved ones. Like those are super, super important. And it makes you realize that you need to, those are like the most treasured things you probably have in your life. Mm-hmm. And I want to be fair, because a lot of people are going, okay, I have none of those. Don't be hard on yourself if that's your scenario. There's a lot of people who have shitty ass parents. And right. Like their brother and sister are fucking crazy and like they're terrible people to talk to, and they moved away from their friends, or their friends are depressed and they don't help to talk to them because they're going through it right now too. Like, don't blame yourself if you're in that bucket. It's not your fault probably. But for me personally, I just focus a lot on those relationships and cultivating them and maintaining them and keeping in touch with everyone. So I always say on the show, dig the well before you're thirsty. But like, no one thinks they're going to be thirsty. They always get, it's like just a clever life help or what, like thing that's on an Instagram post until you're thirsty and you're like, holy shit, I'm so glad I have people around me that I can lean on, because that's where I get mine. I'm not saying again that other people have to have that, but for me, that's really important.
I have to find this quote because I read it right before we started talking, and it's the Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's the five remembrances. And he said, one, I am of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. Two, I am of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. Three, I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Four, all that is dear to me and everyone I love are the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Five, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. And I was thinking about what you and John were talking about in your podcast. And I have a lot. I was raised Catholic and have a lot of very complex feelings about the concept of God or And I'm very resistant to the magical thinking that is kind of everywhere. And I love that. That to me is everything. That I, my actions are my only true belongings. When we really drill down, we're powerless over like everything.
Yeah,
you know?
That's so true. Yeah.
Like civilization is a very thin veil. We live on a fault. There's no guarantees that the drivers that are on the road are going to obey the laws. I am so certain in so few things, and the things that I'm even certain about, I'm not if I really think about it. And I have been thinking the existential crisis that I'm always having is, you know, what do you lean into in those dark nights of the soul? So I love to ask people, what is their thing that they turn to? A lot of people do turn to faith. Somebody said to me the other day, well, you can just choose one or the other. But yeah. I'm too analytical. You know, my brain is like, I wish I could just choose that and be like, this is real.
I'm with you. I've always, people who I know that are like atheists, but are in the asshole camp of atheism, you know, where like everyone who believes in something is an idiot. And I hate that because
I hate it too.
I'm not in that camp. I'm like, I just think, you know, I do envy people that go, well, you know, this is fine because God has a plan for me. And I'm like, fuck, I wish I believed that was true.
Yeah.
Like, how nice would that be? Because I get letters for Feedback Friday on our Friday advice shows on the Jordan Harbinger show.
Yeah, I love those.
I get letters. I appreciate that. I get letters. Like, one that's coming up is like, this woman was like, I fell asleep on our way back from the beach, and when I woke up, we were in the air, and I knew immediately that my 10-month-old son was dead as soon as I opened my eyes. And I'm like, oh my God. And then that, like, and she's like, my husband had fallen asleep at the wheel or passed out at the wheel of the car, and then he also died. And she's like, and I just remember thinking to myself, like, how do you get over that? And she's done an amazing job and built a different life for herself. But I'm thinking, imagine if during that super hard time, you're laying in a hospital bed with like a broken everything and a dead family. And you go, this is just a test. God is testing me. And you believe it in your heart, and you know that it's all going to be okay because you're going to heaven. You're going to get reunited with them. And it's just a test from God. And like, that must be the most comforting set of beliefs you could possibly have. And if I could do anything to convince myself that that stuff was true in my heart of hearts, I would have done it a long time ago.
Yeah, I had a woman, Nikki Mark, on the show, and it was very hard interview. Her 12-year-old son went to bed and died, and they still don't know why. Just in the middle of the night, like no explanation. And in her instance, she was very go-getter, type A, not really that spiritual. And that experience, like she basically overnight had like a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess you would have to.
It's like trauma-induced, though. It's unfortunate. Yeah.
Unfortunate, but she's really... She feels like Tommy is with her all the time, and she's now started this whole organization. And I mean, what she's done out of this unthinkable tragedy is beyond inspiring, in the way that she's able now to connect to people who have lost their children, which is a whole separate, you know, you become a part of a horrible group of people, you know, like a horrible club when that happens to you. And she was really... Yeah, it was really a moving episode. I think I cried through most of it.
That's so horrible. As a parent, I'm like, I can't even... Before I had kids, whenever people were like, oh, I would die for my kid, I'm like, well, you say that now. And now I'm like, now that I have a 2-year-old son, I'm like, I would cut my own arm off in 1 second without even any questions. Yeah. If you just give me the damn saw, if it was like, oh, your son's gonna die, or you can just cut off your arm and your leg, I would just be like, give me the saw. Like, there's not even any, it's so weird how this changes you. So the fact that there's people out there where like that happens to them, as a parent, you just feel your heart like ripping in half, you know, when you hear about this kind of thing. And so having faith or having spirituality in your life would be such a comforting thing to have.
Yeah, I'm with you on the not knocking people, even though there have been moments where I have felt that presence of something. Maybe it's a creative force or grace. I don't know what it is. So I've had moments where I feel like I can glimpse something much bigger than me, obviously. I don't have any doubt that there's something bigger than me. Whether that thing cares about me is where I really draw the line.
Yeah, I feel you. Like, the universe will provide. Dude, you're less than a speck of dust in the universe. Calm down.
I know. Yeah. I was talking to someone and they're like, no, you just have to tell yourself that God is love and the universe is abundant and just go look at nature. And I was like, well, here's a story for you. I was watching these birds and they were all eating. And it was a beautiful snow day. I was visiting my family and they live by a bird sanctuary and it was like a cardinal and a blue jay. And it was just the ocean in the background and the most magical sight. And I was thinking, wow, nature is so loving and abundant. And as I had that thought, a hawk flew down and massacred one of the birds. Blood everywhere. The children who were in the room were screaming. It immediately became like this. I was like, God is laughing at me. If there is a God, he's laughing at me. Because for one moment, I was like, maybe there is a God. And it was like, the universe is abundant.
He's up there going, hey, St. Peter, check this out. Like shred, ripping it open with the talons. And the kids are screaming. It's like, every time, never gets old.
Yeah. He's having a moment.
Yep.
Send in the hawk.
Yeah, that is a great sort of metaphor, right? Because people go, oh, the universe is abundant and everything is great and like love and peace and everything. And you go, wait, where does like peace and love and all that, where does that show up in nature? It is brutal out there. Yeah.
Go to the desert.
Yeah.
And talk to me about peace and love. It's definitely interesting. Everything in the desert has been basically attuned to survive the harshest conditions and everything's trying to kill you all the time.
Yeah.
And I have a good friend who is a Holocaust survivor as well. And I love his perspective on this. You know, he's very, I would say, humorous about kind of, I can't imagine what your perspective would be. You know, I think he understands deeply the hawk metaphor where it's like, yeah, there's a lot of good and there's also a lot of violence and destruction. And that those two sides of the same coin are kind of spirituality.
They are. Like, if you look at old faiths, they always have the duality or plurality. There's always... This is recent. I just read some story about how in England... Have you heard about this? There's, like, these chalk mountains. So there's these mountains that are made out of chalk. Like literally, like, white chalk or whatever. And they think that the old name for England, which is Albion, which means white land, might have come from the fact that inside these mountains, it's all white chalk. And they're finding, using some, like, laser whatevers and, like, satellite stuff, they're finding all of these carvings into the mountains that are done by using like deer horns and wooden shovels to scrape through all of the grass layer and expose the white chalk. And then they quarry other white chalk from elsewhere and they fill in the trench and they make these figures that are like hundreds of feet wide or tall, like giants and horses and all this stuff. And they're like, oh, these are old pagan faith symbols that are from like 500 or like 500 BC or even before that. And they're all pretty dark, except for the ones that are sort of dark and light. Like, they'll be like, this is a fertility one. And then across from it is like a giant holding a human head. And you're like, that's not, you know, this is not like a loving God that never makes anything go wrong. Like, they respect the fact that, like, it's not all roses. In fact, it's mostly maybe not, you know. And
life,
like,
was so cheap back then.
I mean,
it just was so hard. And we take it for granted, I think. And that's why my favorite of all the myth and in mythology, it's always Trickster. That's that book, Trickster Makes This World. It's one of my favorites because it really, it's like, that to me feels more like God, you know, like
more accurate.
Just that nature of like he who dupes others and who also dupes himself. And just that's why I even made up the word. It was like I kept experiencing these moments where I'm like, am I just a butt of God's jokes? if there is a God, he's laughing at me. It reminds me that Calvin and Hobbes, that guy was just a genius. Watterson, he's a I mean, just a genius and perfect work of art, in my opinion. And there was the Calvin and Hobbes where he's sitting on the hill and Hobbes asks Calvin, do you believe in God? And then there's a blank frame where Calvin's thinking about it. And then he looks out at the audience and he's like, well, someone's out to get me. Mm-hmm. And that, in a nutshell, I was like, being raised Catholic, that's about as close
to.
Yeah,
that sounds about right.
That
sounds
so good.
About right. There's a lot of old, I was thinking about the old faith thing. I don't want to drag it out too long, but I was thinking even in Asian spiritual, right? There's yin and yang and like these other symbols. Like there's almost no faith that has stood the test of time. And even when you look at like new-ish faiths, like some of the newer ones, they still have elements of this. We might choose to focus on like all of the greatness that so-and-so, you know, God provides or whatever. But if you look at anything, even Old Testament or older, or New Testament and older, there's a lot of bad shit in there. And I don't mean it's bad as in objectively bad. I mean evil stuff in there. There's a reason they spend a lot of time writing about that, right? And Genesis has the snake in it. It's not about people frolicking in a garden in the end, right? There's still a freaking serpent in there. Like that, it is an indispensable part. It's just that I feel like in modern society, we've just sort of chosen to ignore all that shit. And I don't really know why, because I'm no expert on it, but... like, we've just decided that it's too painful to face, maybe. I don't know.
It is. I mean, it's like if you've ever been around anyone who's dying, or they're, like, whether it's someone dying of cancer or old age or anything, we are so shielded from how messy that process is at the end in our society in general. And it's not pretty. You know, it's not pretty on the way in, and it's definitely not pretty on the way out either, unless you are one of the few people lucky enough to just like die in your sleep.
Yeah, and I know, we should be so lucky, right?
Yeah. I have two questions I ask everyone at the end. What is your biggest defect of character?
Oh God, my temper. I like, even when I know that I should be more patient, and that I plan to be more patient, I will still go and do some shitty thing or say something that I knew I shouldn't say. And I know before I even do it, and I like can't even help myself. Sometimes I'm getting better at it, thank goodness. But it sucks, because I will wake up and go, all right, I'm pretty pissed about this thing, but I'm not going to be an asshole about it. And then I'm compelled to do some element of that, even if it's just passive aggressive. And I'm like, did that help my relationship with this person, or did it not? And I'm like, I knew not to do that. I knew that it wouldn't. And then I did it anyway. What the fuck is wrong with me? I hate when I do that. And I feel like shit every single time.
Yeah. I would never have guessed that you had a bad temper.
Nobody does. I don't like yell at people and explode. Measured. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't like detonate. My dad was the one who would like detonate and explode, but I'll say something or imply something, and it's like, you knew that was going to make that person feel bad, and you just did it anyway, even though you fucking knew that you weren't supposed to, but then you did it. Why? And it's like, what did I get from that? You know, I felt better like very temporarily. And I know that I get that from my dad, but I remember my whole life, I was like, not going to do that when I grow up. And now I'm like, oh man, I'm doing that. Why?
Yeah.
It's the
worst.
Like
a ninja with your little stars. Like,
oh, where's that thing you said you would do? Are you seriously giving me grief about that right now? After all of the other things that I did today, or like dealt with today, you're going to mention the one thing that you know. And I'm like, yeah, I should be better than that. But I'm like, I'm not. Not right now.
No.
It sucks.
You're human.
I got to do. Yeah, but I don't want to do that to my kid.
No, like, yeah.
I don't want to be the dad who's like, oh, all A's except for this. Not very good at art, huh? You know, like, what the hell? Like, why would you do that? And yet, I'm like, I know there's going to be times where I do that. I need to get through that.
Oh, that I understand. I'm getting uncomfortable listening to you, because I don't yell at people. I'll minimize them. You know, my temper shows up that way. And I recognize that even when I was a little kid, I remember being like, oh, I know how to like destroy someone with words and make them feel like shit. And I don't have to yell. And so I'll think, oh, I've got my temper under control because I don't yell. But it's really like you're chasing those words as they're coming out of your mouth. Like, why am I saying this?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't yell. You just do kung fu, and they still get slammed onto the ground. And you're like, ha, that was effortless. So it couldn't have been that bad. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no raising of voices, even though I was like.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. I just jabbed you with a bunch of needles. No big deal.
What's your biggest asset?
You know, I'm the kind of person that when I say I'm going to do something, I usually set up a system and do it. So my mother-in-law, who's an Asian mom, so not easy to please, right? She's like, you always do what you say you're going to do. never really meet people like that. Really impressive. You know, I'll be like, I'm going to lose weight. And it's like, done. I do it. I'm going to work out 3 times a week. And everyone's like, yeah, right. And then like 2 years later, I've missed like one session because I was projectile vomiting. You know, like that's it. And I just, I'm able to do that in my business. I'm able to do that with, like, I've been studying Mandarin Chinese for like 9 years. And everyone's like, oh yeah, you're going to learn Chinese? Sure, bro. And it's like, I'm still going. So I really do have that sort of like stick to it-ness that is great for business, like the consistency. Which is great for things like business. Yep. So I got that from my dad too, though. The same guy that taught me to frickin' blow up about nothing is the same guy that was like, get up early, do your shit, don't complain about being tired, keep going, and then eventually retire early and be like, why did I work so hard? Just like me. That's where he's at. He's like, retired early, and he's like, fuck, that was, didn't really need to spend all that time at the office.
Yeah. I love that. It sounds like he was a big influence in your life.
He is. He's still around. He's a totally different person now. He like doesn't get mad at anything.
That's all that
it's crazy.
Oxytocin that floods the system once they hit a certain age.
Yeah,
the
is it?
He starts going down and the love vibes start going up. And that's why with men, a lot of kids will be like, why wasn't my dad like that with me the way
totally.
They are with their grandkids?
That's
and
it.
It's actually chemical.
That's interesting you should say that, because my mom, who's also still around, they'll come and visit. They're coming next week too. They'll come and visit, and my wife will go, oh, it's so cute how my dad plays with my son. And my mom will go, yeah, wish he could have done that when we had Jordan. And Jen's like, what? He didn't do that? And my mom's like, are you kidding me? No, definitely not. He was like always working, and then he'd come home and be like hangry and stressed out. It's like, no, it was a totally different guy. So it's everyone's like, your dad? No way. He's so cool. And I'm always like, fuck you. You know, because they like don't believe me.
Yeah.
No, he's great now. He couldn't have been like that. You're exaggerating. Okay.
It's the low T and the rise of the, I think it's the, like the oxytocin, the
bonding
the one. Yeah.
Oxytocin. Yeah. That totally makes sense. I think also not commuting in 6 a.m. traffic to go to Ford in Detroit and then skipping lunch and then coming home in 6 o'clock traffic only to do it every single fucking day of your life. Like that, I think not having to do that anymore is probably also kind of nice and easier on his like stress levels. Yeah.
Yeah. Not having to provide. Yeah.
Yeah.
The provider burden is real. It takes a lot out of people.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that.
Well, this has been amazing. I could go Rogan
Thank
length
you.
With you, but I am very respectful of people's time. So I will free you.
I appreciate it. I'm going to go pick my kid up from school because that's the thing I'm doing now.
Where can we find you?
The Jordan Harbinger Show, Harbinger. It's just, look, if you like podcasts, which you do, check out the Jordan Harbinger Show. I don't sell anything. I mean, you know, I'll shill a mattress like a motherfucker on my podcast, you know, like we all have to do to pay the bills. But I don't have like life coaching courses.
They're
or anything.
Great mattresses.
They're phenomenal. I've never gotten a night's sleep like I have on one of those. But yeah, check out the podcast. I'm also at Jordan Harbinger, Harbinger on Instagram, Twitter. I answer all my messages. So I'd love to hear from people who heard this and see what they think.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
It's time for the weekly check-in with Bridget and Cousin Maggie.
I'm so tired. Bridget is lying down, doing this check-in from a prone position.
We did a really great check-in about secrets and the
families and
the secret of life, and then we lost it.
We just delved in and discovered the meaning of life.
And then it's all gone. You're never going to know it, and neither are we, because we don't remember anything. We just shot Dumpster Fire, and I am always so drained at the end of them.
Yeah, it takes it out of you, for sure. It's a big, Dumpster Fire is a big production. I don't think, I feel like whenever we let anyone see the amount of work that goes into it, they're like, oh, this is a lot of work.
Because it doesn't appear that way when you just watch it. It looks like I just sit down with some papers and we roll.
And like fling your ponytail around.
It's sad but true. Effort does go into that.
That is, Dumpster Fire is us really trying and working hard.
And we wonder why we're not millionaires.
Why we can't hit 50,000 subscribers to save our lives.
Inching our way to 50K, a biography of online obscurity. 20 years she tried to get noticed, but nothing happened. It was just a slow crawl to her death. And then
the world took notice.
And then the world suddenly cared. That's my E! True Hollywood story. No, it's fine. I actually like the... We were reading journal entries from my 1989 journal.
Uh-huh.
I should just open one randomly and read it.
Okay, here you go. This is a My Diary with a little lock on it.
It's got gold. You know those old ones embossed. From the 80s that had like the gold embossed? Yeah.
Pages.
It's always scary for me to just open my journal and read it. This morning, May 7th. This morning, we woke up and went swimming and then had breakfast. After breakfast, we checked out and went looking for houses. Then we went to real estate agents to make an offer on a house we saw yesterday. My mom at first was real excited, but by the end of the day, she was crying because we couldn't afford it. I love the first entry in this journal. It is fucking wild. It's January 1st. Today, my sister learned how to walk on skates. We have a small pond in the back of our house, and we skate on it every day. It wasn't a pond. It was literally like a marsh that my dad would flood, and then it would turn into ice. I am learning to skate backwards. My dad is teaching me. He is a great skater. He put lights up so we could skate after school at night. My sister is 4 years old and can swim the doggy paddle and now is learning to skate. She is amazing. We just moved to this house a week before Christmas. We're renting the house. So my mom was a wreck because my dad was usually in New York City. Everything happened this Christmas and the explosion of Flight 103 in Lockerbie, Scotland, where a bomb was found. Everyone died. That was my first entry.
I love your awareness of global events at like the age of 10. I was completely oblivious to that shit.
Maggie, you're still oblivious to true. It. Nothing has changed.
The only reason I know what's going on at all is because of dumpster fire.
I'm still hyper aware of them and you're still oblivious. I remember that like it was yesterday, that flight. Well, A, I think I was probably hyper aware of it because my dad was flying Pan Am all the time. And when he was going to Russia, and I think it was a Pan Am flight. And it blew up over Scotland, and all the images that the media showed were of like freaking children's backpacks and stuff. Or a teddy bear. I just remember one of the images that they showed was like in a field in Scotland, and it was like a teddy bear. I don't know why I was watching this, but
aww, that's sad.
But then even it's just such a loaded diary entry.
Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there.
Moved a week before Christmas. No wonder my mom was insane.
Uh-huh.
And my sister was, the sister I'm talking about who's four wasn't even the youngest. She was the second youngest, which means there was also a two-year-old.
Oh my God.
And I was like nine.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And I'm like, everyone died! Exclamation point.
And then later in the diary, the first entry you read is about moving and going to buy a house.
Oh, yeah. The first entry. That's right. Because then we moved again.
Uh-huh. You guys were moved every year and a half.
Yeah, it was nuts. So we moved to that house. Okay, so that must have been right when we moved to Wilton, which would have been in the middle of my fourth grade year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're moving mid-year, like in the middle of the school year.
Nuts.
That's crazy.
That was the craziest time, too. We had like us. That was when we all got the chicken pox, and we were all sick, and we moved in the middle of the year, and my...
Did Didn't your mom have like
my mom
pneumonia?
Had walking pneumonia that she got from some Russian we were like nursing back to health in our basement.
We probably shouldn't be talking about that publicly.
I still have no idea why that Russian was down there and my dad denies he was even there. I have a long history of being gaslit.
That's why you're so good at sussing it out.
That's why I have no chill for it. I can't remember if my dad got... Oh, yeah. My dad did get mad at me about talking about that stuff on Glenn Beck once.
The Russian in the basement?
Just that I thought he was like a spy.
Spy.
Or I implied it. And he was like, you know, Bridget, if Putin hears that... I'm like, Putin's not going to fucking hear me on Glenn Beck's radio station.
You never know.
Got to. My dad gets like assassinated.
By Putin.
My dad gets pushed off a balcony.
Oh, boy.
Because I read my journals on an obscure podcast called Walk-In's Welcome.
Talked about them, and he was like, that's what happened to Vladimir.
I guess my mom saved that guy's life. Little do I know, my mom was probably nursing that guy back from some poisoning.
Oh, God.
I was like, what? Remember when we were like that guy was sick in the basement? And my dad's like, what guy? I was like, okay, I'm never getting a straight answer out of you.
You're like, we all remember this, Dad.
Nope, never happened.
That's crazy, but it is the perfect cover. I mean, who's going to go looking in a house with five kids in it?
This is true. All with the chicken pox. And I got the chicken pox twice because I was the oldest.
That's terrible.
So I got them and it wasn't as bad. And then they burned through my siblings and then they came back and got me, which is why when people are like, I understand why people are like, this virus can get stronger as it moves through the population. I'm like, yeah, I can. I was in a situation just like this with chicken pox.
My chicken pox were terrible. I had them when I was 5 and my mom was pregnant. Like she was about to have my brother. And so she went and like gave birth to my brother and could not come see me. Like my mom, I was so sick. I had them like down my throat. I was like, it was a really bad case. I remember being so sick and my mom like couldn't come near me for 2 weeks because like she had to stay at my grandparents' house with my brother because he was a newborn and she couldn't be exposed.
Wow.
And like potentially give it to my brother.
Wow.
It was so, I just was like so miserable and sad.
I was so miserable. I got the second time they came back around, I got such a bad fever that they had to put me, we were in a hotel because we were like in between. And they had to put me in a bathtub filled with ice in a hotel.
Ugh.
Because my fever was so bad.
God. Yeah, no, I have specific memories of like waking up and being really feverish. Dogs. Oh. Is it a delivery?
I have no idea. My husband, who's fucking responsible for at least one screw on that
dog coming
Jeff
loose.
Bezos. No, on the fucking ship.
A screw. I feel like he bought a booster, one of those booster rockets. He funded it by himself.
It's ridiculous. This is why my dog has like door aggression now or whatever. This is like 5 Amazon packages that come a day. I can't blame him though because I just secondhand use them. I deleted my Amazon app and then I'm like, can we get this or that? Yeah, it was nuts.
Yeah. And now they have a chickenpox vaccine. So the kids these days don't need to suffer through chickenpox.
Kids these days don't even know what the chickenpox are like. That's why they're soft and changing their names and genders.
Chickenpox are horrible.
Yeah, I still have scars.
Mm. It was so bad.
They have a chickenpox vaccine?
Yeah. The kids today don't get chickenpox.
Wow.
Yep.
Those little fuckers. I mean, good for them, but they get to buy weed and they don't get chicken pox. These kids know nothing.
They don't even know what it was like.
Sure, they've been locked up in a global pandemic for a year and a half. And sure, their development has been stunted and they might have emotional disorders for the rest of their lives. But they don't know what the chicken pox are like.
Tune in next week for another riveting episode that will change your life, help you get out of your own way, and solve all the world's problems. I want to thank our composer, Jared Elias, my co-producer and cousin, Maggie, and all of you out there listening. This has been Walk-In's Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you're welcome. It's the dumbest line.